Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business, and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
And welcome, everybody. Welcome, welcome. Well, when spring arrives, two things are foremost in my mind. One of them is travel and where I want to go, what I want to see in the upcoming year. And the other is healthful living, because we have to climb out of our big winter coats and our boots, and there's nothing to hide how we look anymore. And today we're talking about both healthful living and travel. Regardless of current health or dietary preferences, rich food, poor food turns a grocery store into a farmer's market and into a micronutrient pharmacy. And I'm going to talk with Dr. Jason Carlton and certified nutritionist Mira Carlton around 12:30 today. This book, Rich Food, Poor Food, really makes you look at food differently. I thought I knew a lot because I've studied nutrition and I do a lot of shows on this, but there was some stuff in here that was quite eye-opening to me. So I'm looking forward to talking to both of those around 12:30 today. We'll also talk with best-selling meatless food writer Sarah Matheny. She has a new book out called More Peas, Thank You. And if you have difficulty getting your family on the vegetable wagon, Sarah's got some great tips to share. But first, did you know that national parks are amongst the most visited destinations in the country? In 2011, they were visited by more than 280 million people. That's a lot of folks. And just in time for spring travel, I sat down with Robert Howells to discuss National Geographic's new book, Secrets of the National Parks, Expert's Guide to the Best Experiences Beyond the Tourist Trail. This is not a regular tourist book. They literally pulled together, I think Robert explains this in the interview, but pulled together a bunch of adventure and travel writers and had them share what's your favorite secret about this park. So let me introduce my guest. National Parks expert Robert Earl Howells has been an editor-at-large of National Geographic Adventure magazine, a correspondent for Outside magazine, a regular writer for Men's Journal, and an author for National Geographic books during his long writing career. Focused on adventure and outdoors. He won the 2009 Lowell Thomas Travel Journalist of the Year Silver Award and has twice won Lowell Thomas Gold Awards for his adventure travel writing. And amongst his book credits are National Geographic books, The 10 Best of Everything, National Parks, as well as Backroads of Southern California, Backroads of New England. And he's an ardent hiker, mountain biker, lives in Southern California. And he's going to talk to us now about Secrets of the National Parks, the expert's guide to the best experiences beyond the tourist trail. Bob, I want to ask you, first of all, to just share a little bit about Secrets of the National Parks with our listeners, why National Geographic put this together and how it was put together.
Well, Secrets of the National Parks was designed to steer people a little bit off the beaten track in the national parks. The national parks themselves are iconic. There's only 59 of them. And within each park, there's usually stellar attractions that everyone knows about. Everyone goes to Yosemite Valley who goes to Yosemite, and everyone who goes to Yosemite Valley goes to Yosemite Falls. But there are thousands of other beautiful, beautiful places in a park like Yosemite. So the idea of the book is to suggest some of those places and steer people away from the most impacted places. And that's not only for the convenience of the park itself, but also for the visitor, because you get to have a true experience of the park, a sense of the solitude that made the park so compelling in the first place.
Yeah, and I was shocked how many people visited national parks, over 280 million in 2011.
Yeah, 59 parks, 280 million people. You can do the math, but also many of the parks are huge. Certainly the ones in the Northwest are very, very large, so there's lots and lots of opportunity for solitude if you're just willing to get out of the car and walk a little bit. This book is not a backcountry guide. We have a few suggestions. Maybe you go 5, 6, 10 miles into the backcountry, but most of the suggestions are within 3 or many even closer. So you can have, they're very, very accessible experiences within these amazing parks.
Yeah, I saw on your website, you said, you just got to get out the damn car and have a look around.
That's right. I did say that, didn't I?
So tell me how this was put together, because you covered 32 of the most visited parks. You got together 10 nature writers with intimate knowledge. How did this all come together?
Well, the editors of National Geographic contacted writers like me who frequently write about and visit the national parks. National Geographic, as you can imagine, has a stable of writers and a stable of photographers, and I happen to be one of the half a dozen or so who contributed to this book, and they've known me from other projects, so they asked which parks I'd be most interested in doing, and even though I've visited more than half of the national parks, I chose the ones in my area because I wanted to revisit them and experience them from the perspective of looking for accessible secrets. It was a lot of fun for me, as you can imagine.
Yeah, and one of those, I've been to Joshua Tree, which you covered, and Death Valley. And Death Valley, a lot of people tend to write off as, oh, it's just desert, it's ugly, but it is actually very beautiful. Talk a little bit about Death Valley and some of the secrets there, if you would.
Yeah, I think Death Valley is quite amazing. And I call it geology laid bare. It's as if someone took a scalpel and just gashed the earth open and said, here's how magnificent the world's geology is. It is astounding. There are beautiful, amazingly quiet, solitudinous places, if that's a word, like the flat valley floor, the salt pan desert floor of Death Valley, which you can see from the car, but you've never lived until you get out of the car and just walk out there, walk a mile or so, it's an easy walk, and feel the tangible solitude of the floor of Death Valley. There's also mountains in Death Valley. It isn't all desert. Mm-hmm. And in fact, some of the mountain hikes that are described in the book are pretty darn interesting. There's one that leads from a set of 8 old charcoal kilns. Those date from the 1890s, and they look like alien spacecraft, a lineup of alien spacecraft, these huge stone structures just up there in the mountains, waiting to be seen, and you're very likely to have no company when you're there. And then from there, you can hike up not a very difficult climb up to the top of Wild Rose Peak and look down on the whole valley floor from up there. So it isn't all desert. There's mountain as well. And in Death Valley, there's a place called Scotty's Castle. It actually is the most popular place in the park. But don't poo-poo it just because it's popular. Scotty's Castle is a pretty darn interesting place. It was developed by a wealthy Midwestern insurance man, and he built it as a retreat from his busy life, and he was an engineer by avocation and put a lot of really advanced features into this place in the 1930s. And when you're there, you can not only tour Scotty's Castle, you can take what's called the underground tour and see behind the scenes at Scotty's Castle some of the innovations that he put into this complex way ahead of their time.
Wow, there's some amazing, I was surprised how many dinosaur secrets there were around. I wonder if you could share a couple of those with us.
Well, certainly in parks like Badlands and Theodore Roosevelt National Park, great dinosaur secrets. You might tell me which ones you were thinking of. Those are the ones that come to mind for me.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, but in any event, dinosaurs walk the earth, and you can have experiences of that and see some great fossil finds and the results of recent fossil digs. South Dakota is amazing, and immediately, the parks themselves might be considered secrets of the national parks, because how many people have visited Badlands in South Dakota or Theodore Roosevelt National Park? National Park in North Dakota, not very many.
Yeah, I think it makes you see the world in a different place when you see historical stuff like that and you realize that these things we see in books actually did walk on this piece of land. You know, obviously I'm from Britain, so a lot of our history is ancient Roman history. And when you go there, there's something very magical about, you know, just imagining what was happening many, many years ago.
Absolutely. And that is throughout the national parks, whether it's ancient history like dinosaurs or more recent history such as pioneer settlers, it's well preserved in the parks, and it's a great thing to be on the lookout for. Some of the more interesting experiences in parks, I think, are seeing old homestead cabins, or I'm in Southern California, so down here, old mining ruins and ghost towns in the national parks. They're very well preserved, and you can poke around and have a sense of what it must have been like. It's always fascinating to muse what it must have been like.
Yeah, I remember going to, the first ghost town I went to was Bodie, if you're familiar with that, out Mammoth Way.
Yeah, Bodie is a state park, so not included in this book, but if you're driving down from the northwest and come down Highway 395, which is the road you might want to take if you're going to visit Yosemite National Park, stop off in Bodie. It is one of the most amazing ghost towns I've ever seen as well.
Yeah, I'd agree.
It's huge.
Yeah. So I'm also beach bump, so let's talk about some of the least crowded beaches that we can find.
Okay. Well, I think we can start close to your home, and that would be the beaches of Olympic National Park. And I know a lot of your listeners would raise their ears at that. Like, what do you mean beaches in Olympic? Olympic is mountains. Olympic is rainforest, which it is, and magnificent mountains and rainforest. But there's also a long, I think it's about 25 miles stretch of amazing oceanfront in Olympic National Park, where you can have some of the quietest, most solitary experiences in all of the national parks, really in all of the lower 48. I think the coastal stretch of the Olympic is just magnificent.
I would agree with you. It is breathtaking. And again, I love that isolation feeling when you're there. What surprised you the most when this book was being put together? Was there something that really jumped out and you thought, wow, I really didn't know that?
There were a few things that did. I'll say for me personally, I did four chapters, and among them were Joshua Tree and Death Valley. And not a huge surprise there, but I was pleasantly surprised to learn that you can and, in fact, are encouraged to go off-trail in both those parks. Because normally it's stay on the trail, you know, all the mm-hmm. signs say stay on the trail, and you're not supposed to wander off because you'll cause erosion, which is certainly true on a mountain switchback trail. But in other parks like those, or in Badlands in South Dakota, or in Wind Cave National Park in South Dakota, you're encouraged to go off the trail. Just walk out into the landscape and experience it as the first people who experienced that landscape might have a long time ago. That was a surprise to me.
Yeah. Now, Secrets of the National Parks is a guidebook, and it's a great guidebook. I mean, I read one review on Amazon where it said, I'm browsing through this book, and it just makes me want to fill the car with gas and pack my hiking boots and take off.
But you read my review.
I read your review. but you're also, you're a very well-known travel writer. You won the 2009 Lowell Thomas Travel Journalist of the Year, twice won Lowell Thomas Gold Awards for your adventure travel writing. Tell us what makes compelling travel writing from your perspective.
I think a storyline that's beyond just the place that you're seeing. Every place I go, I'm looking for the depth of it. I'm looking for the cultural history behind it. I'm looking for quirky, interesting aspects that give it more resonance than simply describing the mountain, describing the trees. I like to put it all in perspective and essentially create a storyline based on the history of the culture and and the physical history and geography of the place.
And as far as National Geographic, the secrets of National Geographic Parks goes, what would you like our listeners to know about this book that we haven't already talked about?
I think that the book is an outstanding touchstone for discovery. You can discover the writer's favorite secrets, and they're great. You can't go wrong if you follow every single prescription in this book. But what would delight me the most, and I'm sure I can speak for the other writers as well, is if you use the book as a touchstone. You discover a trail, you discover a waterfall that maybe you had never seen before, but in that process, you see a branch trail, and you go, well, I wonder what's down there. And you wander off and have another experience that's not in the book, and you make your own discovery of a secret of the national parks. I think that's how the book is most useful, as a touchstone, as inspiration for a little bit of discovery and self-discovery in the national parks.
Sounds awesome. I can't wait to pack my hiking boots, Eve. The book is called National Geographic, Secrets of National Parks, Expert's Guide to the Best Experiences Beyond the Tourist Trail. Robert Howells, thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, Vicki. Thank you.
And you can find out more about Robert Howells, or Bob as he prefers to be called, at his website, bobhowells.com. He also has a blog there. And he does some really interesting work. And it really is a good book. And at the back, there's 20 more secrets that they didn't include in the book. They put it in there as an appendix. I was going to read one of the stories to you, but I can't pronounce the name of the river. So you're going to have to buy the book instead. And Eric was no help. All right, we're going to take a very quick break. And when we come back, I have another interview for you with Sarah Matheny. Please stay tuned.
We can find America down the trail of freedom. Walk the way of my fathers from sea to sea.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
OMG! Grammar abuse is no LOL! Hire a copywriter today and make sure your business communications rise above the crowd and deliver the results you need. Call 800-495-7617 today. BTW, IMHO, copywriters rule. Call 800-495-7617. BFN.
Next Monday on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Like so many others, Dr. Alicia Marr spent much of her young life struggling with a short attention span and was often at the mercy of her impulses. During her first year of studying psychiatry as an intern, the doctors she attended called for an intervention. Diagnosis: ADHD. Compelled to address her condition holistically, Dr. Marr embarked on a 15-year course of study, including practicing and teaching academic medicine, maintaining yoga and spiritual practices, even living in a yoga ashram retreat, and observing medical cases during her travels to over 30 countries. We'll find out more about her new book, From Scattered to Centered, Understanding and Transforming the Distracted Brain, when she joins Vicki next Monday at noon Pacific, 3 p.m. Eastern, on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
In the small town of Elmira, New York, a boy was born into an all-American family. The odds of him opening his own clothing store at the age of 18? 1 in 138,000. Excited to be a part of pop culture, he packed for the big city. The odds of finding someone to invest in his vision? 1 in 4.5 million. The odds of him achieving his dream in the fashion industry? 1 in 23 million. The odds of having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 88. I am Tommy Hilfiger, and my family is affected by autism. I encourage you to learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
On the AM band at 1150 and on the FM HD band at 98.9 HD3. Alternative Talk 1150.
Down the trail of freedom, walk the way of my father's.
And welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And I'm going to be brave and attempt that name I couldn't pronounce before the break. But I think it's Ohana Pecosh River, which is it runs through a campground from the glacier down at Mount Rainier. And one of the author's secrets was that most people know about the river and appreciate its stunning beauty, but fail to realize it holds a treasure: native cutthroat and rainbow trout hide in plain sight within those waters. And they recommend you try fly fishing for these feisty fish to truly experience the river. So
That sounds gorgeous. What's the name of the book one more time? Because I think I want to get a copy of it.
I thought you were going to make me say the river again.
No, not the river. But
Ohana Pecosh.
Yes.
The book is called Secrets of the National Parks, The Expert's Guide to the Best Experiences Beyond the Tourist Trail.
Excellent.
And just as an FYI, Nat Geo, National Geographic, has a whole bunch of these books out, guides to trees, to what you might find on the beach, all kinds of things. Next week, I'm actually talking with somebody who wrote a book on money. Same kind of series. They're really good books. Yeah. All right. So I have another guest lined up for you now. I interviewed Sarah Matheny the same time, right after I interviewed Bob Howells last week. And I'm going to bring that to you for the first time today. She once was a divorce and custody attorney, but she left the practice of law and meeting the demands of billable hours, and now practices patience and meeting the demands of a toddler and preschooler. And she started writing a blog. One thing led to another. She wrote her first book, Peas and Thank You, which became a New York Times bestseller. And she now has a new book out called More Peas, More Peas, Thank You. 85 vegetarian recipes for delicious and healthy meals. And she's all about helping families move to, you know, maybe 1 or 2 days of meatless meals a week. And here's that interview now with Sarah Matheny. Well, Sarah, I want to thank you for joining us on Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. And the first question I want to ask you is how you went from a divorce attorney, custody attorney, to being mommy blogger and successful food author.
Well, what happened was I was living the fast-paced lifestyle of an attorney, you know, living on Diet Coke and protein bars and thinking that that was just fine. And then I became a mom, and I became a stay-at-home mom, and I realized the way I was feeding myself wasn't a good example for my children, and it wasn't really developing the good eating habits in them that I wanted. So I started trying to feed my family better, and in doing so started chronicling it on our blog, Peas and Thank You. And that's when it really all just took off, and we realized that, you know, we were onto something here with developing really healthy recipes that are affordable and simple and that any family can incorporate into their lifestyle.
Yeah, and I think so many people are turning more to plant-based diets, but with a family, you might kind of think that's overwhelming. So tell us how you started with your family, or did you do it from day one with them?
No, it definitely was a transition for us, and I think the key is to realize that it doesn't have to be black and white. You know, it's not either you're a vegetarian or you're not. You don't have to certainly eat to fit a label if that's all you're going for, because that doesn't even necessarily mean that you're going to be eating healthy. I mean,
sure,
there's things like, you know, tons of junk foods that happen to be vegetarian and vegan, but that doesn't make them healthy foods. So it's really about balance and it going at the pace that's right for your family, whether it's just incorporating a meatless meal once a week or whether it's something more than that, and not really announcing it to your family and saying, okay, now this is what we're doing, but really just serving up the meals to them and letting them be the judge of whether or not it's something that tastes great before you say, this isn't healthy tonight.
Sure. Sure. Now, a lot of kids don't like vegetables because they think they're not supposed to like them. And a lot of people say, well, just disguise the vegetables, but you're not a huge proponent of that. Tell me why and how you incorporate vegetables into their diet.
Well, I think if we're hiding vegetables in our kids' food, we are teaching them that they are something that they're not going to like, as you said. And so I think if we teach them that vegetables are good for us and that they taste great and we find the vegetables that they like, the techniques that we use to cook them or serve them in a way that they like, you know, for example, my daughter thought she didn't like carrots. Well, once I started roasting them and serving them with a little ketchup, she realized, hey, these are pretty great. It's carrot fries, you know? So it's just finding ways to present the vegetables to your kids that are appealing to them, because when you do that, you're teaching them skills to enjoy these foods for the rest of their lives instead of just sneaking them into their food.
Mm-hmm. From a personal perspective, why did you decide to eliminate animal products? I read it was all Sarah Palin's fault.
Yeah, I happened to see a video when she was running for president. She went to a turkey farm and to pardon a turkey when she was serving as governor. It was kind of a traditional thing that they do, is every governor pardons a turkey. Well, in the background, unbeknownst to Ms. Palin, but very obvious to all of the viewers, was a turkey being slaughtered. And I had never seen such a thing in my life. So to just watch this graphic process going on, it just really made me think about, okay, that turkey that's on my plate was a living animal, and is this really, you know, a type of the whole factory farming system, is this something I want to participate in by what I choose to put on my plate? But just because that was a choice that we made for our family, I don't want your listeners or anybody to think, you know, that it has to be something where they have to go vegetarian overnight. You know, it really can be just finding local humane sources of your meat if you're choosing to eat meat, and then finding ways to make it something that's not necessarily a food that has to be at every single meal, but just an accompaniment now and then.
Right. So, and some of the recipes in here just sound wonderful. I mean, you've got pumpkin cream pie, oat bran, whole wheat ginger pear waffles for breakfast. How much time do you spend in prepping food and in cooking food? Because when I talk with people, that's always a major concern and always an excuse for not eating healthy.
Right. I think the key is to being a little bit organized when you prepare food and finding the time when you do have to cook to prepare things in advance. So in this book, for example, we have a feature where we have a little icon on each page that tells you these meals are freezable. These meals are great for packing in lunches. These are things that you can prepare ahead of time, stick in your freezer or your fridge, and use them, you know, down the week when you're busy and you don't have time to make something healthy. Pull the soup that you've already prepared out and heat that up or whatever it is. But really the key is to having these recipes be quick to throw together, because I'm busy just like everybody else, and none of these meals are really elaborate or things that are going to take a great deal of time.
Right. You have a section in the book about substitutions. Talk about some of the substitutions you use instead of sugar, etc.
Well, some great things that we use is for example, whole wheat pastry flour is what I used in most of my baked goods. You know, enriched white flour that we buy at the grocery store has all the nutrition stripped from it. And so when you are incorporating a whole wheat pastry flour, at least for part of that flour, you're still maintaining the light, fluffy texture of your baked good, but yet you're getting all the nutrition from using a whole grain source. Another ingredient that I love is almond milk. You know, there's a lot of dairy intolerance in our society and, you know, problems with asthma and things like that come from consuming a lot of dairy. So if you can substitute almond milk, you're getting that same rich, creamy texture to smoothies and other things that you might use milk in, but yet, you know, it's not having the lactose and the other things that sometimes cause problems for people.
Right. And, you know, there are kids, it doesn't matter. I loved vegetables as a kid. I was one of those strange kids who actually really loved vegetables. But, you know, I can think of my brother swallowing Brussels sprouts whole because he didn't like the taste or the feel or the look of them. What do you do if your children have something that they don't like and you'd really like them to try to eat it?
Well, we have a one-bite rule in our house, and so if I'm making something that I know is going to be not necessarily the most popular thing on their plate, they at least have to try one bite, and then I round out the rest of the plate with foods that I know that they do like and that will keep them full, so if they decide to not choose more than one of those bites of those Brussels sprouts or broccoli or whatever it might be, that they're still going to have full bellies and not go to bed hungry. But I think consistency is the key because, for example, my five-year-old thought she didn't like broccoli, but I just kept putting it on her plate. I didn't let her get out of it. It was just one bite each and every time, and now it's not even an issue. She'll eat all that I serve her. It's still not her favorite thing on the plate, but at least, you know, she's come to learn that, you know, just because you don't like something once doesn't mean you're always going to hate it.
Right. Talk about some of the treats that your kids like, because you do want them to eat healthy, but you still allow them treats. So talk about some of their favorite treats, if you would.
We have some really great desserts in this book, and I think some of the ways that we make them healthier is by substituting out, you know, some of the oil and butter with applesauce and just cutting back on the sugar overall. But they love, like, we have a Thin Mint cookie that's a knockoff of the Girl Scout cookie. We have snickerdoodle cookie dough balls. We have oatmeal raisin cookies. Just basically all the things that kids love and enjoy, but just tweaked a little bit to make them a little bit healthier.
And I love this, double chocolate single chin brownies.
Now, we have fun with our food, we do. And you know, so in that recipe, for example, I took out some of the butter, added some applesauce, but then I doubled up the chocolate. I left the cocoa powder in, but then I also added some chocolate chips. So there's ways to just make food still appealing and still fun, but much healthier.
And you test all of these recipes yourself, right? You create them all yourself.
Absolutely, yes. No, my family gobbles them all up, and I take them to friends and neighbors, and, you know, everybody that wants to try them is more than willing. And, you know, so these have all been tried and tested, and I take the guesswork out of it. You just have to pick up the book, and it's all right there for you.
Right. It's awesome. And tell us how you got your blog to become so successful, because a lot of mommy bloggers are out there trying to do the same kind of thing. What were some of your secrets of success?
You know, I think just being really transparent and being who we are and not trying to put on a front about who we are. You know, my family, we're quirky and lovable just like every other family, and I just, not hiding or putting on this act that we're perfect, because we're not. And, you know, my kids do funny things, and I screw up all the time, and it's just sharing those things because it makes it relatable and it makes it something that people want to come back, not so they feel bad about how their family's eating or what their family's doing, but really so they can relate to what we're going through as parents and families, but also, you know, get those tips and tricks in those areas that we all might need a little help with, like healthy eating.
Yeah, and whether you've got kids or not, I mean, there are 85 great vegetarian recipes in here. The book is More Peas. Thank you. A final thought you'd like to leave our listeners with, Sarah?
Well, I just love everybody to know, if they want to come check out and see what we're all about, you can go to peasandthankyou.com, and that'll tell you how to pick up either of the books, or also just check out our recipe page. We have hundreds of recipes on there, and you'll see, you know, how this really can be done, and you really can feed your family healthier.
Great. Thank you so much. Appreciate you being with us today.
Thank you.
And that again was Sarah Matheny, author of More Peas, Thank You, 85 Vegetarian Recipes for Delicious and Healthy Meals. And Sarah lives down in Salem, Oregon, and you can find out more about her at her website, at her blog, peasandthankyou.com, peasandthankyou.com. Please do stay with us. When we come back, we're going to talk with the authors of Rich Food, Poor Food. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals at Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
This is Martha Norwalk. Every Sunday morning, beginning at 9 a.m., thanks in part to Dr. Penny Lloyd of Connection the Best Medicine, we cover the world of living successfully with your animal friends. This week, April 14th, it's a Behavior Training and Healing Sunday with me, I'll have open phone lines throughout the show. I'll answer any questions you have about your animal friend's health or behavior. So if there's something going on with your animals you want to talk with me or a related topic, give me a call. Martha Norwalk's Animal World, Sunday morning, 9 a.m. to noon, right here on Alternative Talk, AM 1150.
Hi, this is Vicki St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
The odds of becoming a signed artist and having 3 number one albums? 1 in 100 million. The odds of going on to win 6 Grammy Awards? 1 in 1.4 million. The odds of this performer having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 88. I'm Toni Braxton, and I encourage you to learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
At Sundown Communications, we find that most of our clients are brilliant at what they do, but they lack the time and resources to write and create business messaging that delivers results. That's where we come in, providing a diverse range of professional copywriting services for fresh strategic web content, PR, advertising and promotion, marketing, speeches, and much more. Call us today so you can focus on what you do best, and we'll do the rest. Call 800-495-7617. That's 800-495-7617.
Thanks for listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Follow me on Twitter at Vicki St. Clair.
Negativity and fear, two staples of talk radio. Well, we figured we'd try something different. Alternative Talk, 1150.
And welcome back, everyone. Welcome back. Well, we are going to talk today with the authors of Rich Food, Poor Food, Dr. Jason Colton and Mira Colton. This is a really great book. I told you at the top of the hour, let me tell you a little bit about it, I guess, and then I'm going to bring them straight on. Jason Colton holds a doctorate in nutrition and has completed postdoctoral continuing medical education at Harvard Medical School and Yale School of Medicine. For over 20 years, he's treated thousands of international clients with his unique and holistic approach to nutritional well-being. And Mira Colton is a licensed certified nutritionist, fitness chef, and integrative health specialist specializing in a sensible, drug-free, micronutrient-based approach to weight loss and disease prevention. Welcome to the show, both of you.
Oh, thank you for having us.
Thanks, Vicki.
And again, the book is called Rich Food, Poor Food. So let's talk a little bit about what the book is and what the book is not, because it's a little different to a lot of nutrition books out there. It's packed full of really great information. So who wants to kick off with that one?
I'll grab it. Well, Rich Food, Poor Food, first of all, the name. Rich Food does not talk about expensive food. That's not what we're referring to. We're talking about things that are rich in micronutrients or your vitamins and minerals, which is really why we're eating. We want to get the most nutritional bang for our buck. And what the book does, unlike many other swap guides, is we really look at food safety and food quality. So some swaps just look at how much fat and how much calories and how much sodium. We don't do that. We focus really on what the food is going to offer you, and also if it's going to keep you safe from a lot of possibly harmful, potentially harmful and dangerous ingredients. We keep them all out of your cart, and we do it in every aisle from dairy all the way through to desserts.
Right. And I read that there are over 40,000 food items on our supermarket shelves. So, you know, it's often very confusing for people when they see things like the word natural and healthy and low fat and 100% choice, when in fact those labels can be totally misleading. So can we talk about some of those common labels and bust those myths?
Yeah, well, you know, it's exactly. So many people think, you know, why do I need a grocery store guide? I know how to shop. I've been grocery shopping, you know, since, you know, I moved out of my house. So, and maybe even before that. But today, the grocery store is just, it's a minefield of, like you said, different terms that may not mean what we think they mean. And of course, manufacturers themselves are trying to kind of almost fool us. So you mentioned the word natural or fresh. Things could be natural, but they could also also still, just because something's labeled natural, they could still be using hormones, pesticides, antibiotics, chemical fertilizers. They could be genetic engineered. That's the GMOs that we always hear about. And sewage sludge, that can still be included in products labeled as natural. So
lovely.
It doesn't mean that products labeled natural are all bad, but we should be aware that of what they can also mean.
Right. We have to be aware that there's marketing involved here.
Exactly. It's just all because they want you to buy the food, and they're going to put words on there that they think you're looking for. And actually, natural is the number one most important word to the manufacturers. 2-1 over organic.
Mm. Supermarkets are all crying foul right now as the FDA proposes new food labeling rules. I heard that most restaurants are going along with this labeling of GMO foods, but supermarkets are trying to put the block on it. So talk to us a little bit about that labeling law and what it means, if you would.
Well, you know, I think that as Americans, we have the right to know whether or not GMOs are in our foods. We're not trying to make the argument of whether GMOs are good or bad. That's for science to come to the conclusion when those studies are done. But all we're asking for is let us know if you're using ingredients that are genetically modified in our foods. And I think that's the first step in the right direction, and I think Americans are ready for that now. California tried to pass Prop 37 a while back. It didn't go through. There were a lot of big companies that kind of stood up and spent hundreds of millions of dollars to block that from occurring. But it's happening in other states across the country where more they're really looking for this labeling to occur. And, of course, Whole Foods Market has come out and said by a specific date, I think 2015, that they're going to label it. I think this is just a great step in the right direction. I think the consumer should really look at this as something good. Now, are they going to label everything? And this is what we talk about in Rich Food, Poor Food. They may label something as being genetically modified. So they may say, oh, this zucchini is genetically modified or this corn is genetically modified. But what they may not do and what consumers have to be aware of is all the ingredients that are derived from genetically modified ingredients. For instance, maybe soybean oil or even citric acid in our food oftentimes comes from corn. So what we do in Rich Food, Poor Food is we identify any ingredient that could potentially come from a genetically modified source so that you as a consumer can make an informed choice.
Right. Now, meantime, until that happens, and hopefully it will happen, because most of Europe has banned GMO foods, I was really interested to see the price lookup codes in your book, and talk to us a little bit about the PLU decoder, if you would, because that will help us for now if those labels are on foods in the store.
Absolutely. Well, the PLU decoders are on the produce, and then they're in the produce section. There's those little stickers that you wash off when you get the dirt and pesticide rinse off your produce. Now, what they do is they're a great way of you being able to look at the number and tell if it's been genetically modified, if it's organic, or if it's conventional. So, for example, most commonly you'll see a four-digit number starting with a 3 or a 4. And that just means that it's been conventionally grown. It's still going to have pesticides on it. And that's what a four-digit number means. Now, you'll also see less often five-digit codes. And they might start with a 9. If you see the 9, grab it, because that means it's organic. So any five-digit code on the sticker starting with a 9 means it doesn't have any chemicals, it hasn't had any pesticides on it, and that's 9. Now, on the other hand, a five-digit code starting with an 8 means that that vegetable has been genetically modified. And as these labeling laws become into play, you're going to see a lot more of those stickers starting to be made because they're going to be forced to put it on there. So any five-digit number starting with 8 means you leave it there in the grocery store because that's a genetically modified piece of produce.
Yeah, I think that's great information. I'm certainly going to start to, I'll have to take my glasses with me from now on so I can read those. I can read those little labels there. I'd like to talk a little bit about dairy because, we think of, unless you're buying what I call plastic cheese, you know, we think we're buying real cheese, but that's not always the case. I was quite shocked to read that in shredded cheese, they often have, tree bark, for example. So talk to us a little bit, if you would, about good cheese versus rich cheese versus poor cheese.
Right. So, you know, sometimes people come to me and say, you know, Jason, now how can block cheese be that different than shredded cheese? Didn't they just shred it and put it in the bag? But that is not the case. Again, with rich food, poor food, when we say rich food, we're looking for foods that are highest in the vitamins and minerals. And again, the poor food part of it comes, we want to protect you from those poor food, potentially dangerous ingredients. And as you mentioned, when they shred the cheese, they put all kinds of different things in there. They put anti-caking agents in there, like potato starch, or cellulose powder, which is really just wood pulp. Mm-hmm. They put it in there because it absorbs the moisture in the shredded cheese. If you've ever seen shredded cheese bags, oftentimes you see moisture build up on the inside of that. Also, sometimes we don't think about the fact that that clear packaging can be the light in the supermarkets can leach out micronutrients, and because so much of the surface area is now exposed when the cheese is shredded, you're losing micronutrients with that. And then they also put in antibacterial type things too, called nataminicin, and that's a dangerous or a potentially dangerous chemical as well. That's designed to cut down on the mold. It's a mold inhibitor. So just things you don't ever think about being in your shredded cheese. It's quite different than just buying a block. We just recommend shredding it yourself at home.
Right. I was surprised to see that you actually name brands in here. You know, do buy this and don't buy that. Anybody come to talk to you about that?
Well, you know, the great thing is they have come and talked to us, but we're actually getting a really good response from manufacturers. We are getting a lot of manufacturers saying, will you look at our products now? How can we change our products now? How can we make them better? And we also have a lot of people coming to us saying, we can give you coupons for some of these products. And that's really one of the things we're so excited about with this book is we have coupon clippers next to a lot of the different products, and those are free coupons that are exclusive to Rich Food readers that they can just come onto our website and grab for free at CultonNutrition.com. So there, I mean, we're having a great response from a lot of the manufacturers. Not everyone likes being chosen as a steer clear person, but no, we haven't received any really nasty letters yet. I'm sure we will eventually.
Right, and it's all, you know, leads to transparency, which hopefully we hope leads to better products. The other thing I wanted to talk about was yogurt, because we hear such a lot about yogurt today. I have always loved yogurt, but I have to tell you, even after 28 years in America, I still prefer European yogurt because of the way it's made. So what's the difference between yogurts? What do we need to look for? What do we need to avoid?
Well, with yogurt, it's the same as milk. So we really look at two things. We want to make sure that our yogurt is organic for the most part. And again, that goes back to those GMOs. Animals that are yogurt that's organic is going to ensure that the animals weren't fed genetically modified feed. And they also make sure that it's going to not include RBGH, which is a synthetic hormone used to increase milk production that can be potentially dangerous to both the cows as well as to the human beings. So that's important. And then you're also wanting to look for a grass-fed milk or yogurt as well, because when the cows are allowed to eat grass, which is the natural diet for cows, we get so many more of those micronutrients. We get the omega-3 fatty acids that are so important for our health. There's all kinds of other things in there too that you just normally don't get. CLA, which is another type of beneficial fat, more vitamin D. So it's just better all the way around. And of course, when an animal eats its natural diet, it's happier, it's healthier, and that just makes a healthier product.
Right.
In the end.
Right. One thing I want to clarify, is the term micronutrient interchangeable with phytonutrient, or are we talking about just plants with phyto?
So it's phytonutrients would be a part of a micronutrient class, but micronutrients is a great question because it sounds complicated, but it's really just vitamins, minerals, and essential fatty acids and phytonutrients, all the good stuff in food. So when people say, oh, this food's healthier for me, it's everything that isn't a calorie-based element to food. So we're not talking about carbs, fats, and proteins. We're talking about the vitamins, minerals, phytonutrients, and all the good stuff in there.
Right. Now, there are vegetables, you call them the Fab 14 and the Terrible 20. The Fab 14, you say, we can pretty much buy those without any worry that they may have been genetically modified. So how do we identify those?
Well, we have a free download on our website also that's a wallet-sized guide that you can just take to the grocery store with you. But this is what they mean. The Fab 14 are things that have very little pesticide residue, and also they're not genetically modified currently. So those are things that you can buy conventionally. It's things like onions, pineapple, avocado, asparagus, mangoes, eggplant, and there's a bunch of those. And then there's the Terrible 20. Now, with the Terrible 20, these are dangerous for two reasons. They're often genetically modified, and they also have the most pesticide residue. Apples, for example, top the Terrible 20. And apples, on average, contain, I think, 42 different pesticides on them. So you really want to watch out and make sure that you buy those organic, especially if you're giving them to your children, and strawberries on there as well, grapes, a lot of things we put in kids' lunches. Additionally, things like yellow crookneck squash and zucchini are on that list because they are genetically modified often. And that's why they're often served at restaurants when they give you a side. They often give you like a little side of some mixed veg, and that's usually like zucchini and crookneck squash. And that's because they're very inexpensive because they're now genetically modified.
That's a very good tip to have. I won't be eating those anymore. You also have a vegetable spray wash recipe, if you will, in your book. Is that downloadable off your website? You say don't buy vegetable spray washes. They're a waste of money. You can make your own.
You just make your own. Now, again, that spray recipe is really in the book. It's on page 143. And just for the listeners today, it's a cup of water, it's a cup of organic white vinegar, a tablespoon of baking soda, and the juice of a half a lemon. You just mix it all up, and you spray it on to the vegetable and just let it sit for a while and wash it off.
Yeah. And what about skin on or off? You know, when I was growing up, I was always told you need to eat the flesh of the fruit as well as the skin, because that's where the fiber and the good stuff is. Where do we stand on that now? Because let's assume we're buying organic.
Right. Well, that's what it comes down to. So a lot of the vitamins are going to be in the skins, and that's where we're going to get those micronutrients that we love to talk about. But, of course, we've got the problem of the pesticides these days. And so, yeah, if you're buying organic produce in general, then I'd leave the skin on, you know, because we want those extra benefits. But if you're buying conventional and they're on the Terrible 20, then you're definitely going to want to wash them carefully and probably peel them as well.
Yeah. There's an incredible amount of information in the book, as I said. How long did it take you to put this together?
Well, we did this for about a couple years, putting all of this information together. And, you know, foods and their ingredients change very rapidly. So, you know, you might start off with, you know, the first aisle, and by the time you got to the last aisle, you then had to start at the first aisle again to make sure nobody has changed their recipes and that we could still actually, you know, call them a rich food if we had once thought they were. You know, we're so happy that food processing and food policy is going forward and in the direction that it's going right now. And we just really want people to vote when they go to the grocery store with their dollars and to buy the things that only contain good, high-quality ingredients. Because, you know, basically, we're going to be able to get the bad foods out of the stores if we leave them on the shelves. And if nobody buys them, they're going to eventually get the message that we want better, high-quality foods.
I really appreciate you both being with us today. Great information. Listeners can find out more about you at CaltonNutrition.com. And Calton is C-A-L-T-O-N, nutrition.com. Thank you so much for being with us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
And my guests there, Dr. Jason Calton and Mira Calton. The book, again, Rich Food, Poor Food. And check out the website, because as Mira said, there are some downloads on there which you will find useful. All right, before we go today, I want to tell you very quickly, since we started the show talking about travel, there is a Northwest Dive and Adventure Travel Expo 2013 coming to Tacoma this year. It's at the Greater Tacoma Convention and Trade Center, April 20th and 21st. Lots of stuff going on there. They have 50 free seminars on everything from underwater photography to first aid, diving skills, great outdoor innovations. They've got over 300 exhibit booths. They have film festival night where they're showing all kinds of underwater diving films. It looks really good. I'm actually going to go. I'll be there myself. But there's also a photo and video competition and a treasure hunt. And if you win the photo competition, you can actually compete for destination trips. So I wanted to tell you that before we left today. Again, you can find out more about any of our guests at conversationslive.net or reach me at 800 800-495-7617, 800-495-7617. You can also reach me at info@conversationslive.net. And you can find me on Twitter at VickySaintClair.com. Vicky St. Clair, at Vicky St. Clair. We're also on Facebook. If you want to jump on there and like the page and make some comments, you can tell us about your business, about your travel trips, whatever's going on. We'd love to hear from you. All right, that's it for today. Until next week, live well, live strong. Thanks for being with us. Hi, this is Vicky St. Clair. If you have a business, service, or event and would like to deliver your message to a large audience, call me at 425-269-4772. Let Conversations Live shine the spotlight on you. Call 425-269-4772.
Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair discusses issues that are important to you, like good health and well-being, finding a new job, and building your business. Overcoming life's big challenges and making sense out of chaos, and living with passion and joy. Join us Mondays at noon Pacific for Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. See conversationslive.net for show schedule and guest information.